All right, welcome to Making the Argument. Before we get started, I have a very important announcement. We have a brand new deal with GoodRanchers.com. That's right. If you go into Good Ranchers and you use promo code Nick and you sign up for one of their subscriptions, you're not only going to get $15 off, but do you remember the old deal where you got 2 pounds of ground beef with each order? Well, we just upped the game. That's right. You can choose top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon now. Every single order you get on that subscription is going to come with free top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon. You get to choose which one if you use promo code Nick. And again, $15 off on top of that. That's a savings of $480 in meat by signing up for one of those subscriptions. Not to mention the fact that if you are looking for a gift for someone that is impossible to shop for, you can go on to goodranchers.com and get one of their brand new gift boxes. Now, this is a limited time only offer. It's part of their overall Black Friday special. So go on to goodranchers.com to get more details. Sign up for promo code Nick in order to get that deal, and let's get on with the show. Hi, this is Nick Freitas, and welcome back to Making the Argument. Today, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're actually going to take a popular left-wing YouTube video, and we're going to go ahead and break it down. Because one of the things that we've recognized, and one of the whole purposes for this podcast in the first place, is to provide you good arguments in favor of conservative values and to fight back against some of the left-wing propaganda that is constantly being thrown at us and our kids. And YouTube and social media is one of the primary ways that we see them doing this. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen a video pushing forward a left-wing message. They are well produced. The graphics are good. The audio visual quality is good. And gosh, there's just something about it that just seems superficially plausible, right? It really tugs at your heartstrings and it makes you think that, gosh, this is something you can really believe in or you've got to really reevaluate. And then they always come up with some sort of political objective, whether it's overt or covert, that they want you to engage in as a result of watching their video, right? They are actually making an argument for their side. And so it's important that we take the opportunity to look at the argument they're making, break it down, look at the logical fallacies, look at the implications, and provide good, thorough analysis. And that is what we're going to do next.
Because one thing I've learned is this, in politics and in combat, cowardice is contagious, but so is courage. And if you're willing to be the first person over those ramparts, you will be shocked at how many people will come with you. I'm asking you to come with me. I'm asking you to be a part of the generation that will restore the promise of this country and breathe new life into it.
There's a chart I saw recently that I can't get out of my head. A Harvard business professor and economist asked more than 5,000 Americans how they thought wealth was distributed in the United States.
All right, so the first thing I want to break out here is the way he's setting this up. So he's talking about a Harvard professor that asked 5,000 Americans how wealth was distributed within the United States. Now, what's interesting about this is, would we really do this with pretty much anything else? Right? Would we ask random 5,000 Americans how they thought heart surgery should be performed? And if they came up with a different answer than how heart surgery is actually performed, would we therefore demand that heart surgery be performed that way? No, I don't think we would. All right, so it's important to understand that he is setting this up to look like this is a real scientific analysis of wealth disparity within the United States or how economics works, and he's not. They basically just asked the opinion of 5,000 random Americans about a fairly complex issue, which they probably didn't provide any real guidance or additional information or insight to before they asked this question. So again, this has a lot of scientific pretense right off the bat without really giving us a lot of meat to it. All right, let's see what he says next.
This is what they said they thought it was. Dividing the country into 5 rough groups of the top, bottom, and middle 3 20% groups, they asked people how they thought the wealth in this country was divided. Then he asked them what they thought was the ideal distribution. And 92%, that's at least 9 out of 10 of them, said it should be more like this. In other words, more equitable than they think it is. Now that fact is telling, admittedly, the notion that most Americans know that the system is already skewed unfairly.
All right. So that's an interesting statement, right? So he talks about what Americans think it is and what they think the ideal is. And then he says, so most Americans already know that the system is skewed unfairly. Okay, well, first of all, that's not even the question you asked. You just asked them what they think it is versus what would be ideal. But the idea that it's skewed unfairly, well, you haven't demonstrated any of that. You haven't demonstrated how these 5,000 people know that it's skewed unfairly. You've just pretty much made that as an assertion. Again, that's not scientific analysis. You've taken 5,000 random people, you've asked them their opinion, and now you're coming to conclusions off of it. Again, not scientific. Let's keep going.
But what's most interesting to me is the reality compared to our perception. The ideal is as far removed from our perception of reality as the actual distribution is from what we think exists in this country. So ignore the ideal for a moment. Here's what we think it is again. And here is the actual distribution. Shockingly skewed. Not only do the bottom 20% and the next 20%, the bottom 40% of Americans barely have any of the wealth. I mean, it's hard to even see them on the chart. But the top 1% has more of the country's wealth than 9 out of 10 Americans believe the entire top 20% should have. Mind-blowing.
Okay, so I want to stop here because this is another point that I think is kind of important, right? You see him talking about quintiles, the bottom 20, the top 20, the top 1%. What does that actually mean? Well, there's a couple different ways to look at quintiles and a couple different ways economists use it, right? You can look at the bottom 20%, middle 20, top 20, based off of the total number of people in the country, or you can break it down on income brackets. And here's what's important to understand. In each case, they make you think that when they talk about the bottom 20%, they're talking about the same people all the time, as if you were born into the bottom 20%, you live in the 20%, and you die in the bottom 20%. Except that doesn't actually happen. If you look at the bottom 20% of the people in this country, what you'll find out is that the vast majority of them are usually people that are younger. They're people that don't have a lot of work experience. They haven't finished their degree. They're doing jobs at a coffee shop or at a fast food restaurant because they're building that initial work experience or they're finishing their education. Here's the other interesting thing. If you look at the top 1%, again, he's making you think that these are the same people that are there year after year after year. And that's certainly true for some people, but in reality, 70% of the people that were in the top 1% last year won't be there next year, right? That was when they built up their business their entire life and they sold it off, or they got a windfall in selling off stocks or whatever it is. But that 1% could have been a lifetime's worth of work so that one year they dip up into the 1%, and then for the following years, they actually drop down into a lower bracket because they're no longer earning the same amount of money, or they've sold their business and so now they're not even close to what they earned before, and they just had a big windfall because of everything that they did leading up to that. So it's important to understand that as you look at these brackets, right? That is not individual flesh and blood people staying there all their lives. Some people might, but the vast majority of people start off at a lower income bracket and move up as time goes on.
But let's look at it another way, because I find this chart kind of difficult to wrap my head around. Instead, let's reduce the 311 million Americans to just a representative 100 people. Make it simple. Here they are, teachers, coaches, firefighters, construction workers, engineers, doctors, lawyers, some investment bankers, a CEO, maybe a celebrity or two. Now let's line them up according to their wealth. Poorest people on the left, wealthiest on the right, just a steady row of folks based on their net worth. We'll color code them like we did before based on which 20% quintile they fall into. Now let's reduce the total wealth of the United States, which was roughly $54 trillion in 2009, to this symbolic pile of cash. And let's distribute it among our 100 Americans.
Okay. this is where some of the real dishonesty, you know, plays out here. He just said, let's just take the $54 trillion and put it into one symbolic pile of cash, as if Native Americans showed up to North America and, oh, there was just $54 trillion worth of wealth laying around. Or settlers landed at Jamestown or Plymouth and, oh my gosh, here's a big pile of gold. Let's see how we distribute it. That's not how this works. The reason why we have $54 trillion worth of wealth in the United States is because people have created it, right? But he's not getting into the discussion of how the wealth was created. He's just assuming that all this wealth exists and that the only question that we really have to answer is how do we distribute it? But that is a complete departure from actual reality. But this gives you some insight into the logic that he's using, right? This seems superficially plausible until you break it down and you start asking some of the more hard, in-depth questions, and then his argument really starts to fall apart. Let's continue.
And let's distribute it among our 100 Americans. Well, here's socialism, all the wealth of the country distributed equally. We all know that won't work.
Okay. If you thought the last comment about just a random pile of cash representing the wealth of the country was dishonest, this is one of the most dishonest things he has said this entire time. So if you're not watching this, he has a thing called the dreaded socialism. So he's putting it in quotes, making it look like those of us that criticize socialism are being unreasonable, because after all, in socialism, that $54 trillion would be distributed equally among everyone. Okay, if that's true, here's what I would like him to do next. Show me the socialist country where that has actually happened. Show me the socialist country of comparable size to the United States that has even ever amassed that much money, and then I want you to show me how it is divided equally within those countries. Because last time I checked, the Castro family has a little bit more than the average farmer in Cuba. Right? When Mao was killing 40 to 45 million of his own people, something tells me Mao was living a little bit better than the peasant farmer that he was oppressing. How about we do something recent? Let's go down and look at the Chavez family in Venezuela, right? Were they really living at the same rate with equal distribution of income to the average taxi driver in Caracas? No, they were all fabulously wealthy, because what really ends up happening in socialism is that money is not distributed based off of the goods and services you provide. Money is distributed based off of political power. So this idea that he would classify socialism this way is so intellectually dishonest and bears no resemblance to actual reality or history of everywhere socialism has been tried as to throw a lot of his argument into question, or at least his motivations into question. Let's keep going.
We need to encourage people to work and work hard to achieve that good old American dream and keep our country moving forward. So, here's that ideal we asked everyone about. Something like this curve. This isn't too bad. We've got some incentive, as the wealthiest folks are now about 10 to 20 times better off than the poorest Americans.
Okay, so again, we have another fundamental problem here. He keeps talking about the ideal. Or saying that because 92% of 5,000 Americans chose this as the ideal, that therefore that's what it should be like. I mean, think about the various decisions that you make throughout your life with respect to career decisions or education decisions or how you spend your money. Would you want to give that all up to a random sampling of 5,000 Americans to make all your decisions for you? I'm guessing you wouldn't. It's equally ridiculous in something like this where we're talking about decisions that affect 330 million Americans. And if you want to extrapolate beyond that, billions of people all over the country that do business with the United States. I want you to think about that. Go back to that scenario where you have the 19-year-old kid working at the coffee shop versus the 50-year-old person that is a brain surgeon. Do you really think the brain surgeon should only be making 20% more than the person working at a coffee shop? Right? Does that brain surgeon provide only 20% more value to their customers than the person working at the coffee shop? Right? Are there, how many more people do we have that could work in a position like that versus could be a brain surgeon? But again, this guy wants to tell you it's ideal. I'm telling you right now, if you're going to tell someone that has to go through 8 to 10 years of medical school, rack up hundreds of thousands of dollars in education debt and malpractice insurance in order to provide work in a very, very demanding job, which probably requires anywhere from 60 to 80 hours a week, and then tell them they only get to make 10 to 20% more than someone that is filling up your coffee, they're probably not going to do that work. So this might be the ideal in his head, but it certainly wouldn't be an ideal reality if we actually tried to implement it.
But hey, even the poor folks aren't actually poor, since the poverty line has stayed almost entirely off the chart. We have a super healthy middle class with a smooth transition into wealth. And yes, Republicans and Democrats alike chose this curve. 9 out of 10 people, 92%, said this was a nice, ideal distribution of America's wealth. But let's move on. This is what people think America's wealth distribution actually looks like. Not as equitable, clearly, but for me, even this still looks pretty great. Yes, the poorest 20 to 30% are starting to suffer quite a lot compared to the ideal, and the middle class is certainly struggling more than they were, while the rich and wealthy are making roughly 100 times that of the poorest Americans, and about 10 times that of the still healthy middle class. Sadly, this isn't even close to the reality. Here is the actual distribution of wealth in America. The poorest Americans don't even register. They're down to pocket change. And the middle class is barely distinguishable from the poor. In fact, even the rich between the top 10 and 20 percentile are worse off. Only the top 10% are better off. And how much better off? So much better off that the top 2 to 5% are actually off the chart at this scale. And the top 1%, this guy, well, his stack of money stretches 10 times higher than we can show. Here's his stack of cash, restacked, all by itself. This is the top 1% we've been hearing so much about. So much green in his pockets that I have to give him a whole new column of his own, because he won't fit on my chart. 1% of America has 40% of all the nation's wealth.
Again, take into consideration the words he's using. He said 1% of America has 40% of the nation's wealth. What does that mean? Is it the nation's wealth? Does the country own that wealth and they just gave it to this 1%? Did all of us get together and start a corporation and now we have this much wealth in the country? It's not the nation's wealth. This is one of the biggest problems with the way that he is trying to collectivize society, right? Individuals earn. The nation doesn't earn things. Individuals that live in the nation earn things, right? So maybe that 1% is making 40% more or making significant amounts more. But the question is what do they have to do to earn it, right? So when we look at a Steve Jobs or when we look at a Bill Gates or when we look at a Jeff Bezos, right? Yes, they make a lot of money, but they also create a lot of value for other people. In fact, if you look at the value that they create for society at large versus what they actually make, they make significantly more value for everybody else than they do for themselves, right? They're actually getting a much smaller percentage of the wealth they are creating. But that's not being acknowledged here because he's talking about it in terms that are dishonest at best, right? They're at the very least, they're incorrect, right? It's not the nation's wealth. The nation is not some, you know, again, we're not some collective. We're individuals that live in society and choose to work and live with one another, right? And as we earn money, that is essentially our wealth, right? Let's carry on.
The bottom 80%, 8 out of every 10 people, or 80 out of these 100, only has 7% between them. And this has only gotten worse in the last 20 to 30 years. While the richest 1% take home almost a quarter of the national income today, in 1976, they took home only 9%, meaning their share of income has nearly tripled in the last 30 years.
The overall implication of what he's saying here is that we were better off before 1976. We were better off, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, because at that point, wealth was distributed differently, right? Here's my question. If that's really true, if the middle class or the poor are worse off now, economically, than they were in 1976, well, let me just throw something out there. Why don't we go ask any poor person, why don't we go ask any person in the middle class, hey, if we had a time machine right now that could take you back to 1960 or 1950 or whatever this guy thinks is ideal, would you want to go there? I'm willing to bet almost nobody would say yes, because the bottom line is you go back then and almost nobody in the middle class or the poor people, they didn't have air conditioning. They didn't have 2 cars per family. They didn't have multiple TVs per family. They didn't have simple things like microwaves, right? What you need to understand about wealth, and what this guy clearly doesn't understand about wealth, is that the distribution, right, is not as important as the overall quantity that's available. So even if the one richest 1% has become significantly more wealthy over the last 30 years, the real question is what has happened to the wealth of the middle class and the poor? Because that's what this guy claims to care about. He claims to care about the well-being of the middle class and the poor. Well, are the middle class and the poor doing better now, or were they doing better 30 years ago? Do they have more access to certain items that would have been considered luxuries 30 years ago? The answer is they're doing much better now. They have much better access now, right? And that is as a result of entrepreneurs being able to work in the economy to provide products and services, bring down the overall prices of things so that they become more affordable and accessible to middle income and poorer people, right? Now, before anybody questions whether I know what I'm talking about, believe me, I know what it is to be poor. I know what it is to be in that bottom 20%. And I'm very, very thankful for the fact that we do have an economic system that allows for people to be able to produce those products and services, to be able to work together in voluntary cooperation in order to provide items that, again, would have been considered luxuries 20, 30, 40 years ago. But when you don't take that into account, right, when you make this all a story of, well, this guy has this much and you only have that much, well, I'm sorry, that's not telling the whole story, and it's teaching us to demonize other people because of their success.
The top 1% own half the country's stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. The bottom 50% of Americans own only 0.5% of these investments, which means they aren't investing. They're just scraping by. I'm sure many of these wealthy people have worked very hard for their money. But do you really believe that the CEO is working 380 times harder than his average employee? Not his lowest paid employee, not the janitor, but the average earner in his company. The average worker needs to work more than a month to earn what the CEO makes in 1 hour.
Okay, again, this is completely disingenuous, all right? Superficially plausible. Like, oh my gosh, of course that CEO doesn't work as hard as the person in the factory. Okay, but here's the problem, right? You don't get paid for how hard you work. You get paid by how much value you create for other people, for your customers, right? So when the CEO of a $100 billion company makes a decision, if it's a good decision, it could mean pay raises for everyone in the company. It could mean more profits. It could mean the ability to be able to expand and invest and hire more people. And if they make a bad decision, the company could go out of business. So that CEO is making decisions that literally affect the lives of sometimes thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people. So yes, they are compensated accordingly. Whereas the average person working at an Amazon distribution site, is their job important? Yes. Is their job honorable? Absolutely. They are providing a product or service in exchange for a paycheck. But the idea that that person might be working harder, and so therefore this guy should get to decide what the pay disparity should look like between the CEO and the person working on the line at the factory, is a little bit ridiculous. Right? This is not about handing off this decision to 5,000 random Americans asked by a Harvard professor. It's not about the creator of this YouTube video. These decisions should be made by people that actually bear some responsibility for the consequences of the decision that they will make. And one of the worst lies that we tell people is that you are rewarded exclusively based off of how hard you work. You know what's really hard work? Digging a ditch with a spoon. That would be incredibly hard work. It would also be stupid work and worthless work, which is why we don't do it. We use heavy equipment, right? But that takes somebody to design the heavy equipment. It takes somebody to actually assume the risk and invest in order to buy the heavy equipment so that when you as the laborer are actually using that tractor, your labor is significantly more value than it would have been if you had to move everything by hand. Right, but a complete lack of understanding of things like capital investment or risk or everything that an entrepreneur has to worry about when making decisions that affect the lives of sometimes tens, hundreds, thousands of people, right, to not take that into consideration when you're looking at things like compensation is completely intellectually dishonest and really irresponsible.
We certainly don't have to go all the way to socialism to find something that is fair for hardworking Americans. We don't even have to achieve what most of us consider might be ideal. All we need to do is wake up and realize that the reality in this country is not at all what we think it is.
Okay, and the reality of economics is not at all what this guy thinks it is. The reality of economics is this. Economics is the study of the use of scarce resources which have alternative uses. Which means that if you look around, all of us have needs, wants, and desires. And not all of those needs, wants, and desires can be met with the resources that we have available. So when we study economics, it's all about how do we find the best way to allocate those resources in order to make sure that people can get what they need to survive and really to thrive in society. Here's what we found. that the closer that you get to socialism, the worse off people get, especially the poor and the middle class. In fact, socialism has a real uncanny way of wiping out the middle class altogether and creating greater income equality in the sense that everyone is worse off, except, of course, for the people that hold political offices. They tend to be the ones that always do the best whenever politicians are the ones deciding how resources are allocated. In a free market society like we have in the United States, here's what we end up finding out, that some people are amazing at allocating resources. Some people are amazing at coming up with an idea and marketing it and getting it out there. But the key in a free market society is they can't force you to buy what they're selling. They have to convince you to do it. You have to voluntarily purchase whatever the product or service is that they're providing. Now, when someone like Jeff Bezos comes up with a way to get you products and services far more effectively and efficiently, far more convenient for you, and you choose to do business with him, that doesn't make him an evil, mean, or greedy person, right? You chose to pay for those products and services, not because you love Jeff Bezos, but because it made your life better. Now think about everything that's going on with the COVID crisis right now, and I want you to imagine if you had to depend on all the traditional mechanisms to get the products and services you want. Imagine a world right now with COVID where there is no Amazon, where there is no UPS, where there is no FedEx. Imagine having to depend entirely on the government to get the goods and products that you want. Something tells me none of us would like that scenario. So let's appreciate something about free markets in general. One, nobody in the free market gets to force you to buy their products and services. You have to voluntarily choose. And you only do so if you think it's going to make your life better. So the chief feature of a free market system is not competition, although that is an important dynamic. The chief feature is cooperation. It's people working together to mutual benefit in order to freely exchange goods, services, and ideas in order to make all of our lives better. Now, will some people make decisions? Will some people assume risks that make them fabulously wealthy? Absolutely. But if they've earned it honestly and they've done so through voluntary cooperation, then standing back like this guy is and trying to determine arbitrarily what they should or shouldn't have, that's not kind, it's not compassionate, and it's not trying to take care of the poor. It's trying to control people, and it's fueling an economic response based off of greed, not compassion or altruism, right? I want a society that allows people to go as far and as fast as they possibly can. Because again, in a society which embraces free markets and encourages voluntary cooperation in the marketplace, the only way you can really get fabulously wealthy is by creating a great deal of wealth for other people. And in that sort of society, we have the right incentives, which actually lifts everybody and allows everybody the sort of economic mobility that they need in order to be successful and live their life the way they want, not some politician and not some guy that's making dishonest YouTube videos. That is all the time we have today on Making the Argument with Nick Freitas. I hope you enjoyed it. Here's what I'd like you to do. Watch this video, listen to it in your car, and then give us some questions. You can email us at team@nick4va.com. So if you have some questions about the video, about the arguments that we made that you would like us to address, we would be more than happy to do it on our next show next Monday. Also, please leave us a 5-star rating on your podcast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're listening to this. The better the ratings that we can get, the more we can actually get these arguments out to the people that need to hear them so that we can be effective communicators and effective advocates for the principles that we believe in. Thank you again for joining us, and we will see you next time on Making the Argument with Nick Freitas. Once again, thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the show, again, one of the best ways you can do it is by heading over to goodranchers.com with promo code Nick. You're going to get $15 off. You sign up for one of those subscriptions and you're going to get up to $480 of free meat with that subscription. You get to pick top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, bacon. It is all up to you. Plus, if you're looking for gifts to get for the people that are impossible to shop for, goodranchers.com also has gift boxes. You need to act quick. This is part of their overall Black Friday special. So head on over to goodranchers.com, use promo code Nick, and once again, thank you for listening.